loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm John Kiriakou, and I'm joined in studio by co-host Brian Becker. In this hour, we take a look at the breaking news of the day. First, Donald Trump is reportedly planning to replace Rex Tillerson as the head of the State Department with Mike Pompeo, who could in turn be replaced as the head of the CIA by Senator Tom Cotton. Hardline Cold Warriors continue to dominate military and foreign policy. Next, Donald Trump attacked British Prime Minister Theresa May after she condemned his retweets of a leader of the far-right Britain First organization, but May has yet to revoke her invitation to Trump for a meeting. Then, debate has begun on the floor of the Senate as Republicans attempt to push forward with a massive overhaul of the U.S. tax system that amounts to a huge giveaway to the rich and the corporations. And then, speaking to a gathering of African youth in Burkina Faso about the horrific reemergence of the slave trade in Libya, French President Emmanuel Macron said, "It's your fault." And finally, Honduran military and police fired tear gas at crowds of demonstrators gathered outside the electoral authorities' headquarters, and opposition candidate Salvador Nasrallah denounces fraud allegedly carried out by the country's right-wing president. That's all starting now on Loud and Clear. But first we turn to the State Department and the CIA. Donald Trump is reportedly planning to replace Rex Tillerson as the Secretary of State with Mike Pompeo, who's currently the CIA director. Senator Tom Cotton would then become director of the CIA. Hardline Cold Warriors continue to dominate military and foreign policy in this administration. We're joined from Washington by Medea Benjamin. She is the co-founder of Code Pink. Medea, welcome.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
Medea, help us make sense of this. What possible good can come to the country by making Tom Cotton the director of the CIA and Mike Pompeo Secretary of State?
No good can come to the country. I think it's extremely frightening. And what it does is put all the ducks in a row for a military confrontation with Iran. That's the way I see it.
Brian, that's really the key here, isn't it? Cotton, more than practically any other member of the United States Senate, has been out in front in his support of a military conflict with Iran. He violated the Logan Act by urging American allies to weigh in against the Iran deal at the tail end of the Obama administration. And he's awfully quick to advocate the use of force against Iran and against any other country that in his perception is some sort of a threat to the United States.
Yeah, it was unprecedented. In fact, Cotton was the freshman senator, was the author or the initiator of the letter from 47 senators to the Islamic Republic of Iran in the middle of the negotiations for the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, the so-called Iran nuclear arms deal. And the letter basically said to the Islamic Republic leaders, guess what? The United States does not have to live up to the obligations under the agreement. And so you better think twice about signing it. I mean, that's unprecedented because you had the head of state in charge of U.S. foreign policy carrying out negotiations with others, not just Iran, but the other countries, the other Security Council members.
Right. It was a multilateral deal.
And trying to publicly sabotage an agreement. It was amazing. I mean, even within the Pentagon, it raised a lot of eyebrows.
Medea, I want to get your take on something else. It's something that nobody yet is talking about, and I think it's critically important. In the event that this personnel transfer actually takes place and Tom Cotton becomes director of the CIA. Now, here's a guy in his 30s. He's very, very...
Just turned 40, John.
Oh, did he? Okay.
He's got a lot of experience.
He's got more experience than I thought he had. No, he really is very inexperienced. He's barely been on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. He has no intelligence experience whatsoever. He's never sat on the Oversight Committee. He's never worked in the intelligence services. He's not going to be able to run that agency day to day. So who does that fall to? It falls to Gina Haspel, who's currently the CIA's deputy director. Gina Haspel was known in the halls at the CIA as Bloody Gina, because of a job she had at the beginning of the so-called war on terror. I am sorry to say that the CIA will not allow me to say what that job was, although it's been on the front page of the Washington Post and the New York Times. What do you think about this? Is Gina Haspel really going to be the acting director of the CIA?
Well, what I remember about Gina Haspel is that she oversaw the torture program. And you know that well, John, and that we have somebody in the who will come to head that agency who has said that waterboarding is not torture. So I think it's extremely scary that somebody who was involved in the torture of detainees and later took part in destroying the videotapes of those interrogations, who is Gina Haspel, will, as you say, be the one behind the scenes who is leading the CIA and is in lockstep with what Tom Cotton believes.
We should remind our listeners, too, Medea, that these announcements have not yet taken place. What we're talking about is a breaking news front page article on the New York Times in which they quote senior White House officials. And to tell you the truth, I believe that senior White House official is Donald Trump because of the author of the piece. She has a very long journalistic relationship with Donald Trump. But in any event, she's saying that senior White House officials are saying that Rex Tillerson will soon depart as Secretary of State, either by the end of the year or just into the new year, and will be replaced at State by Mike Pompeo, currently the CIA director. Senator Tom Cotton of Arkansas would then be named CIA director. That's what we're talking about, but that announcement has not yet come from the White House. In any event, let me ask, how do you see CIA operations or even State Department diplomacy then changing under this more conservative, more activist, more evangelical leadership if it comes to pass?
Well, I never thought I'd see the day when I would be rooting for the former head of Exxon, but Rex Tillerson, given the array of characters in this administration, has been one of the adults in what Bob Corker called the adult daycare center of the White House. And he has been, while he has been undoing the State Department, he has been a moderating force there. And now that force will be gone and be replaced by somebody who is a rampant anti-Russia, anti-Iran hawk. And then, as we just talked about, replacing the head of the CIA with somebody who says that the problem is not the Iran deal or Iran's weapons, but the nature of the Iran regime. So I think that we're going to have a new set of characters in there who want to go with to war with North Korea, think that we can bomb Iran's nuclear sites, that want to see regime change in both of these countries and don't think about the consequences of that, and that the, quote, moderating force now of Rex Tillerson will be gone. Who knows what, I mean, Mattis must be behind all this because it wouldn't happen without him. So it is scary indeed.
You know, John, even though the White House has now issued the statement that they're not, no personnel changes have been made as of yet. That's the latest news that we're hearing. It's not just one story. It's all over the place. The Washington Post front page, White House readies plan to oust Rex Tillerson at State. Medea Benjamin, you and Code Pink and other people in the anti-war movement have been particularly concerned about the escalating tension between the U.S. and the Democratic People's Republic of Korea or North Korea. North Korea just set off a latest intercontinental ballistic missile test. The North Koreans say they have now completed their testing so that they are a full-fledged nuclear power. Rex Tillerson was lectured, well, humiliated by Trump publicly, sort of chopped off at the knee, saying, oh, dear Rex, stop wasting your time. No sense in negotiating with little rocket men, meaning the head of state, Kim Jong-un. What do you think, Medea? What does this all portend for? We've talked about Iran, but what does it portend perhaps for Korea?
I think it means a ramp up of U.S. aggression against North Korea. I think it means that the hopes that we had for negotiations with North Korea are out the window. I think there's going to be larger U.S. Military exercises that portend a quote decapitation of the person that Trump calls a little rocket man. I think we're in for a very difficult period with North Korea. And unfortunately, North Korea is not going to back down. And will these new characters be ones who can negotiate a tougher deal with China and Russia to put the pressure on North Korea? I don't think so.
John Kiriakou, you are with the CIA. Obviously, you are no longer with the CIA. You went to prison for revealing the CIA torture program to the public. But you know the agency. I mean, how do you think people who actually work at the CIA would take Tom Cotton as the director?
I think they would not take him seriously. I think that, you know, it's part of the CIA culture, Brian, where if they don't like or respect a president or a director, they know they can outwait these guys. You, if you're in the CIA and you've made it up to the senior service, you've been there 25 or 30 or 35 years, and presidents and directors come and go constantly. And so what they do is they just begin ignoring orders that come from the White House. Or when they receive an order from the White House or from the director, they say, yes, sir, we're going to get right on that. And then they just sort of slow roll it until it goes away. It's overtaken by events. The next thing you know, you've got a new director, you've got a new president, and you just move on.
All right, we're going to keep following this story. We'll see if it, in fact, comes to pass that Rex Tillerson will be ousted from the position as Secretary of State. We've been speaking with Medea Benjamin. She is the co-founder of Code Pink. She's a journalist, longtime leader in the U.S. anti-war and peace movement. Thank you, Medea. You're listening to Loud and Clear. After a short break, we'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker.
And I'm John Kiriakou.
Donald Trump attacked British Prime Minister Theresa May after she condemned his retweets of a leader of the far-right Britain First organization. But May has yet to revoke her invitation to Donald Trump for a meeting. We're joined from London by George Galloway, legendary anti-war activist and former British parliamentarian. Welcome back, George.
It's great to be here.
So, you know, Donald Trump, when he was tweeting his angry response to Theresa May today, he tweeted it to a different person at first. Did you know that? It was another Theresa.
Could have been worse. There is actually a porn star by the name of Theresa May, and he could actually have tweeted it to her. Imagine.
Yeah, I don't think it was to the porn star.
No, it wasn't. It was to an innocent woman of great virtue who had only 6 followers.
Well, he deleted that tweet. And of course, Donald Trump, being the arch malignant narcissist, we might call him, because Theresa May had to come out, obviously, to say, hey, that's not a good idea to be retweeting fascist anti-Islamic stuff. Anyway, how's it playing out there in where you are in the UK?
Well, a rare unanimity has ascended in the nation. Everyone from the Conservatives to the left are up in arms about this brazen interference in our internal affairs. First of all, the very thing that the United States is complaining about in other circumstances, and the failure not to back down, but to double down on the insult, adding insult to injury, to attack the British Prime Minister for doing what she could not avoid doing, of saying this actually is really not helpful, has caused tremendous backlash. If I could just deal with 2 aspects in particular. First of all, the videos that he retweeted were, in fact, in one case, fake news. As you know, my wife is from Amsterdam, and an event took place 10 miles from Amsterdam in which a person with a brown face attacked a person with a white face on crutches. And in this video, it said that the assailant was first a migrant and second a Muslim. In fact, he was neither a migrant nor a Muslim. And so the video itself was fake news. It had nothing to do with immigration and nothing to do with Muslims. The other two videos appear to me, I haven't actually studied them too closely, but they appear to me to be examples of the wanton cruelty and wickedness of the Al-Qaeda, ISIS-type jihadists, who are, of course, the United States' ally in the Middle East. The weapons that they have, the motor vehicles that they drive, the money that they spend, either comes directly from the U.S. or, at the U.S.'s behest, from the U.S.'s closest friends and allies in the Persian Gulf, places like Saudi Arabia. What any of these three videos had to do with Britain is, of course, impossible to discern. And the second point, as you have alluded, is he was retweeting the British equivalent of the Ku Klux Klan, actually much worse than the Ku Klux Klan, I think, because these are people who are deeply implicated in the murder, recent murder, of a British parliamentarian, a woman, a young mother of young children, who was murdered in the course of her public duties by someone chanting the name of this organization as he stabbed her and shot her to death. So you can imagine the shock that this has created in Britain. Now, as someone who has spent his entire life trying to get the British people to shake themselves of the illusion that the United States was their leader, that there was a free world of which the United States was leader, and that the United States was even, in some minds, our father. It's never been easier, Brian, so it's an ill wind that blows nobody any good.
I think that's absolutely right. You know, one of the problems that we have with Donald Trump, and I think now not just Americans recognize this, but people all over the world, is that he never, ever backs down. Even in the face of insulting our friends and allies, knowing that he's clearly wrong, he always doubles down. So here's Theresa May. And believe me, I'm no great fan of Theresa May, and I'm sure you aren't either, George and Brian. But here's Theresa May, who's trying to take the high road in all of this. She does not respond directly to this incendiary series of tweets. And then Donald Trump gets angry, and he tweets again. And he says, Theresa May, don't focus on me. Focus on the destructive radical Islamic terrorism that is taking place within the United Kingdom. We are doing just fine, ending with his customary exclamation point. All this is destructive. There's no upside to an exchange like this.
No. And he's saying that you're doing just fine. As far as I can see, in Las Vegas, just a few weeks ago, where 500 people were shot by automatic gunfire,
right,
a story which has mysteriously disappeared from our news, at least. If that's doing fine in combating terrorism, I don't know what doing badly would look like. Theresa May did the very least that could have been expected of her. Britain is supposed to be the United States' ally, indeed lingers under the illusion that we're your closest ally. And here's the president on Twitter willfully doubling down and insulting the British prime minister, insulting the British people. And this is quite unprecedented. I said on the BBC earlier today, I don't know if it translates across the water, but if I'm ever at risk of getting into a Twitter spat, my wife takes the telephone off me. It's a pity that Donald Trump doesn't have a wife that does the same thing.
Well, John Kiriakou has a theory about that.
Yes, I do. I tweeted last week that I truly, genuinely believe that Donald Trump tweets while he's sitting on the toilet in the morning, because it's the only time of the day when there's no one around to restrain him.
Well, the effluent that emanates from his Twitter account might be suggestive that you're correct on that, John.
It's just a theory, folks. It's a theory. It's a theory. Well, what will happen, though, now that Donald Trump, again, because of his narcissism, because of his doubling down because everything is always about him. And in the past, at least, the United States, underneath U.S. policy, the same sundry interests were protected or defended or advocated for. But nonetheless, it would seem to me that Donald Trump is being quite harmful to the interests of the United States as a global force, and certainly harmful to U.S.-British relations, which have been, quote, a special relationship for a long time. Nonetheless, Theresa May in trouble on so many fronts. Will she keep the invitation? Will she meet with Donald Trump?
Well, firstly, I hope that the United States is weakened as a global force. I wish that the United States would concentrate on being fine in their own borders. But unfortunately, that isn't true. I do want to have good relations, of course, between Britain and the United States. We are, as Oscar Wilde said, two countries divided by a common language. And I would like our relationship to survive this presidency, however long it lasts. But the issue of the invitation is now rendered effectively null and void because it is inconceivable. Indeed, frankly, I hope he does come because if he comes, as a veteran organizer of mass demonstrations, I can tell you there will never have been a mass demonstration like the one we'll be able to muster against any visit to Britain by Donald Trump. And it would be wonderful to see literally millions of British people out on the streets giving him the kind of welcome he deserves.
Well, that's actually a topic of conversation here in the States. We've been waiting for the British government to rescind this invitation, and that withdrawal of the invitation hasn't come.
But anyway, George is predicting that it will have to come.
Right.
Well, I mean, eventually, I think it will be impossible for him not to come here. I think they'll try and arrange a touchdown here, much like Elvis touched down at Prestwick Airport in the west coast of Scotland, and nobody knew he was here. It might be something like that. It certainly won't be a golden carriage down the Mall with Her Majesty the Queen, not least because the golden carriage is not bulletproof. And I'm sure that the millions that would be on the streets would make its passage impossible. So I don't think it will be rescinded because that would be an escalation on the British part. I don't think that will happen. I do think that Trump will eventually come here. And even if he does touch down at Prestwick, we'll organize the biggest demonstration in history.
Yeah, it's really something. When you're a global empire, when you're the number one power in the world, and you're hated or your leader is hated so, you know, widely, even by your closest ally, that's just not good.
That's not a good thing
for an empire, even an empire with an amazingly strong military machine. Anyway, we're out of time. We've been talking with George Galloway. You're listening to Loud and Clear. After a short break, we will be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou in the studio in Washington with Brian Becker. Let's turn to the tax plan. Debate has begun on the floor of the Senate as Republicans attempt to push forward with a massive overhaul of the U.S. tax system that amounts really to a huge giveaway to the rich and the corporations. We're joined from San Francisco by Daniel Sankey. He's a financial policy analyst. Daniel, thanks again for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me.
Daniel, the Washington Post and the New York Times yesterday said that Donald Trump's recent pronouncements that people like him, that is, billionaires or people who claim to be billionaires, would be paying far more taxes under this plan. Both of those papers said that that is simply not true. And in fact, it's the people who are at the bottom of the financial rung, or I'm sorry, it's people at the bottom of the financial ladder who are going to be paying more taxes, certainly as a percentage of their overall income. What kind of plan are we looking at here? Has the House plan changed dramatically on the Senate side?
It's not changed dramatically. I mean, ultimately, overall, what we're looking at is huge corporate tax rates, which will cause, you know, massive budget deficits. So we're making up for it by taking away tax benefits and tax breaks that working people and middle class people have enjoyed for decades. It's really kind of remarkable. And, you know, previous times on the show, I've said that, I don't think it'll go through. I think it'll, you know, he's so incompetent that it'll fall apart. But honestly, I think I've kind of changed my opinion on that one. I think it looks extremely likely that some form of it will go through. They're going to do this so-called 20-hour voterama where they're just going to try to throw in all kinds of ridiculous, regressive policies, everything from allowing churches to, which are nonprofits, to share political opinions, to making abortion access even more restrictive. Just throwing this all in is somehow that's, you know, related to tax. So it's a huge blow to progressive people everywhere, to working people everywhere, and a huge handout to the corporations and the ultra wealthy.
You know, it really is. I have to agree with you on a number of points. I really didn't believe this was going to make its way through Congress. I thought that there were so many Republican senators who had very closely held positions on their own pet tax issues that a final deal was just going to be impossible to push through. I'm struck too by a piece in Politico today. They're quoting a fellow by the name of David Mendels, former chief executive officer of a software firm called Brightcove. He said that the Republican tax plan is, his word, bonkers. And he says here, frankly, I think they're bonkers. It really doesn't work that way. No CEO sits there and says, when my tax rate goes down, I'm going to hire more people and pay them more money. It's true. You know, we experimented with trickle-down economics in this country between 1981 and 1989, and it just simply didn't work. What happened was that it ballooned the deficit. Now, here we are with a national debt that is so big most people can't count in numbers that high. And the Congressional Budget Office is saying that this is going to severely increase the national debt. I'm not sure where the Republicans think they're going to get the money to pay for this tax cut. Can you enlighten us on that?
Well, I'll tell you where they're going to try to get it is from people who traditionally enjoyed certain tax breaks. They're going after high tax states like California, New York, and Connecticut, which have written off their taxes at the federal level. So they are trying to severely eliminate and restrict that tax benefit, meaning that people then end up paying increased amounts of taxes through the federal end. They're also trying to put legislation that will essentially kind of solidify this policy in those states, which will essentially mean that these, you know, communities in those states that have made the decision that they're willing to pay high taxes because there's all these social benefits that come with it, that they want their communities to benefit from those social benefits, making it much more difficult for those communities to enjoy those social benefits and to pay those taxes, and basically forcing those states to become kind of tax hawks. Because what they'll see is their population being hit really hard with those tax increases. So, you know, you're going to see all kinds of amazing and wonderful things like arts programs getting cut. Healthcare is going to be more restrictive. All sorts of helpful social services, you know, that people need during times of crisis being eliminated because the tax burden is going to be so heavy. It's kind of remarkable. I mean, Trump has really solidified himself as a president, not of the United States, but of a very particular reactionary right-wing pocket of the U.S., and is completely willing to insult, attack, and sell out a huge populations in the U.S. who do not make up his base.
You know, you make an important point, too, that there's a ripple effect to legislation like this. I happen to live in Virginia, which is a relatively low tax state. I live in Arlington, Virginia, and the taxes are slightly higher in Arlington. But Arlington and Virginia as a state are both very, very well managed. I'm happy to pay higher taxes because we have the best schools, we have the best parks, we have the best roads, we have a very small homeless population because the homeless are actually taken care of. There's food, there's affordable housing. I'm happy to spend the money. I'm happy to pay my taxes. But as you say, if this legislation passes and people like me are no longer able to deduct the state and local taxes that we pay, the alternative is to start to phase out these programs. And so at every level, people are going to start getting hurt.
Absolutely. I think that really it's, you know, it's just kind of Robin Hood in reverse and him, you know, taking from all these programs. And it really limits the ability of these individual communities to govern themselves and make decisions about how they spend their wealth and what they spend it on. You know, okay, fine, maybe you're a conservative and you don't agree with the high tax rates and the social programs. That's fine. But it's up to the community to make decisions as to how their money is spent. And if they disagree and vote in a different direction where they say the social benefit of affordable housing is much better than having huge homeless encampments sprawling all over the place, then they have a right to do that. And they have. They've consistently voted in that direction. And this is a way of hamstringing that. I also think we need to talk about, you know, this is a huge handout to corporations. It will also hurt economic growth overall. We have to talk about a little thing called aggregate demand, and it simply means that corporations can't make money if people can't buy what they're selling. With this constant cutting away of social benefits, well, how are they going to pay for social benefits? Well, it's going to have to come out of the pocket of working people, people who enjoy things like education and healthcare. So they're going to have less money to spend on other things. And it's going to hurt the bottom line. People aren't going to be able to buy the things that they want to buy. They aren't going to be able to put money in the pockets of these corporations. So it's a huge drain on the economy. It's a huge drag on economic growth. So it's not even going to really benefit, you know, these organizations, these corporations that supposedly it's giving this huge handout to.
Daniel Sankey, Brian Becker here. Yesterday, graduate students around the country marched. They went on strike. We're protesting because not only does this bill not make sense for most people, it's actually a form of cruelty, and it also is a way of harming particular parts of the population so that money can be directed to the already very, very wealthy. Talk about how this impacts graduate students.
Yeah, absolutely. So the part of the tax plan that they're trying to kind of wedge onto it highly favors highly privatized education over education that is funded in part by, you know, the public tax dollars. So what it does, it not only highly favors these private educations, but it highly favors those that are, quote unquote, providing, you know, job skills or job training. And what that means essentially is incentivizing and pushing these schools to essentially just provide the skills that, you know, multimillionaire corporations want, rather than educating people to become thoughtful, intelligent, critically thinking citizens. And it's also punishing those schools that tend to push more in that direction if they want people to have a holistic understanding of the world, be able to think critically about it, to just people having very specific skill set that the corporations need to produce whatever commodities they need to make money off of. And so this is a big part of graduate students are going to this advanced training. It's very expensive. It's very costly. And this is going to further increase the burden on them and make it harder for them to obtain loans. It's going to put caps on the loans they can take out and the amount of the they can take out. And it's also going to make it harder to get debt forgiveness.
Based on the literature that I was reading yesterday for graduate students, if you're a graduate student and you get your tuition paid for, you do a lot of things in exchange. You do research for professors. You do all kinds of other things in the classroom. You teach. You might get a stipend of $34,000, say, and you also get a tuition comes free. Now, if let's say that tuition costs $60,000, under the new tax bill, if it stands, the House version, that $60,000 that you didn't get as income will be treated as income. In other words, the $60,000 tuition waiver, and that graduate student who has a $34,000 stipend will now have to pay taxes not on $34,000, but on $94,000 or $84,000. And thus, a lot of working class graduate students won't be able to stay in school for advanced degrees.
Exactly. I mean, talk about hitting a vulnerable population below the belt. You know, these are students. They're spending a ton of their time educating themselves, which is not particularly profitable, and are struggling to make ends meet, sometimes working extra jobs, working those internships and those teacher's assistant positions and whatnot. And this is just arbitrarily raising the taxes on them, saying that somehow, you know, now their education is income, which is absurd. It completely de-incentivizes people to seek higher education like that. It makes our population less educated, less capable of, you know, meeting the challenges of this century. And it just hurts us. It weakens us. It's a terrible idea, and it will have significant long-term consequences if it gets put into place.
All right. That's all the time we have. We've been joined from San Francisco by Daniel Sankey. He is a financial policy analyst. You're listening to Loud and Clear. After a short break, we'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker, speaking to a gathering of African youth in Burkina Faso about the horrific reemergence of the slave trade in Libya. French President Emmanuel Macron said, "It's your fault." We are joined from Houston by Dr. Gerald Horn, a professor of history at the University of Houston and author of many books, including Race to Revolution, the U.S. and Cuba During Slavery, and Jim Crow. Welcome back, Dr. Horn.
Thank you for inviting me.
Dr. Horn, it's almost impossible when one reads the text of Emmanuel Macron's speech in Burkina Faso and many of his other speeches about Africa not to come to the conclusion that this man is a racist. We know about French imperialism in Africa, but Macron is, you know, leader of France in 2017. It's really amazing. Talk about Libya. Talk about Macron and what his orientation has been.
Well, I think that these African students were justifiably and understandably concerned about France's role, along with the United States, by the way, in toppling the Gaddafi regime in Tripoli, which has unleashed a tidal wave of instability leading to these very disturbing pictures that many of us have seen of Africans being sold as slaves. And obviously, that helped to inflame his audience in Burkina Faso. But there are many other reasons to be concerned about Mr. Macron. Of course, he has the justifiable reputation back home of being president of the rich, which is quite fitting for a former investment banker. He also has the rather despicable reputation of being Donald Trump's best friend in Europe. And keep in mind as well that this display of arrogance on the part of Mr. Macron was not unusual for a French leader. And I think that your reference to French imperialism helps to underscore that this is not just a personal flaw on his part. It's a structural problem stemming from the fact that France's pretensions to being a major power basically stems from its gross exploitation of Africa. And that's why even preceding Mr. Macron, President Sarkozy and Hollande also have been accused, understandably, of making difficult and obnoxious statements with regard to Africa and Africans. And then we're talking about Burkina Faso. Recall that some decades ago, they had a leader, Thomas Sankara, who was a leader of a new type, a kind of Che Guevara in office in the center of Africa. He was stoutly and staunchly opposed by Paris, which ultimately led to his being deposed and, in fact, assassinated. So I think that there is good reason for this protest in Burkina Faso of Mr. Macron. And I might say one more thing, which is that many of our friends on this side of the Atlantic oftentimes raise questions, which to me are rather specious, about the Chinese role in Africa, but they rarely have a mumbling word to say about the French role in Africa, which is much more devastating. Keep in mind that a few years ago in Côte d'Ivoire, which is the site of this African Union, European Union summit, that there was an electoral dispute between the incumbent Laurent Gbagbo and the man who succeeded him, President Ouattara. French paratroopers invaded Abidjan and overthrew Mr. Gbagbo and installed a successor and then bundled off Mr. Gbagbo and his spouse to be standing trial at The Hague for various crimes, most of which were imaginary. So I think there's understandable reason why there's been so much hullabaloo about Mr. Macron's disastrous tour of Africa.
Indeed, indeed. And the French, I remember in Cote d'Ivoire, coming in with their helicopters, guns blazing, as they captured the head of state and took him off for international crimes. Only the imperialists, only the Western powers, only the colonizers get to take people and treat them and subject them to so-called courts in Europe, where they are relentlessly and usually not only found guilty, but given long prison terms or greater. Here, in when he's talking to the African students, Macron went out of his way because he was obviously, well, the media says he lost his cool, but he said, it's not the French who are the traffickers, it's the Africans. So everyone should understand the responsibility, and we've started to do that, to dismantle them. But stop the argument saying it's someone else. Now, here's the French government. The French government played a vanguard role within NATO, insisting on the bombing of Libya after Resolution 1973 was passed by the UN Security Council. That resolution stated that the UN was authorizing member states to use force in Libya to protect civilians. And yet we all know, based on what happened, that NATO kept bombing and bombing, mercilessly bombing the country until the head of state, Gaddafi, was eventually lynched in the streets. And that's when Libya came apart. There was no slave trade going on, open air slave auctions in Libya during the era of Gaddafi. Just on the contrary, in fact, Gaddafi and the Green Revolution and Gaddafi's role in the OAU, the Organization of African Unity, was such that Libya played a premier role, at least it seems so from a distance, in terms of its stance, in terms of the anti-colonial project for all of Africa.
Well, it's not only that. Recall that under Mr. Gaddafi, Sirte, which is a place that was very dear to his heart, was slated to be the capital of a united, independent Africa, just like Brussels is the capital of the European Union. As we speak, because of the depredations and devastation inflicted by Paris and Washington, Sirte is an outpost of religious zealots and fanatics. I don't think we should necessarily see that as somehow accidental or coincidental. But I think that these African students had another reason for protesting Mr. Macron's visit. Recall that it was in 1956 that, along with Israel and Britain, Paris launched a piratical attack on the Egypt of G.A. Nasser, which had sought to nationalize the Suez Canal, inflicting murderous crimes upon the Egyptian people. This was in the midst of France fighting an ultimately losing war against rebels in Algeria, culminating in independence in 1962 and ringing down the curtain on French colonialism in Algeria that had begun in the 19th century. But if we go back a little bit further, we'll also recognize that beginning in the 17th century, France began kidnapping Africans from the area around Senegal, one of their major colonies, dragging them across the Atlantic in chains to be enslaved in what is now Haiti. And, of course, after the Haitian Revolution, 1804, France inflicted reparations on Haiti. And that is to say, the enslaved did not get reparations. The slave masters got reparations, which helped to dig a deep hole for Haiti, which it has hardly been able to escape. And then, I have not even mentioned France's dastardly role in the assassination of Patrice Lumumba in Congo approximately 50 to 60-odd years ago, speaking of January 1961, which helped to plunge that sprawling African nation into a spiral of unrest that it has hardly escaped from as we speak. So I think that those African students were protesting Mr. Macron with good reason, and they deserve our unstinting support.
I couldn't agree with you more. And I'm glad you mentioned Algeria because, again, at least over here, something that is largely unknown, that revolution, the revolution against French colonialism by the Algerian revolutionary fighters for national independence, it was called the Revolution of a Million Martyrs because so many people were killed by the French. And all of that role in all parts of Africa, certainly in North Africa and West Africa, that's been largely whitewashed. I mean, people just, at least here, those who are getting their information from the corporate-owned media, they just basically don't hear about that.
Well, you are correct about that. And I think that there is another unfortunate reason why that is taking place. That is to say that there was a settlers' revolt in Algeria, which helped to make the war that unfolded rather bloody, just like you had a settlers' revolt in North America in 1776. And the structural flaw in France's relationship with Africa comes from the fact that foreign reserves of these African nations are stored and warehoused in France, which gives France the opportunity to play with the currency and play with the economies of independent African nations. Those students deserve our unstinting support.
All right, we're going to leave it there. We've been joined from Houston, Texas, by Dr. Gerald Horn. He's a professor of history at the University of Houston, the author of many books, a prolific writer. One of his books, Race to Revolution, the U.S. and Cuba During Slavery and Jim Crow. You're listening to Loud and Clear. After a very short break, we'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker.
And I'm John Kiriakou.
Honduran military and police fired tear gas at crowds of demonstrators gathered outside the Electoral Authority's headquarters. And opposition candidate Salvador Nasrallah denounces fraud allegedly carried out by the country's right-wing president. We're joined from Tucson, Arizona by Chuck Kaufman. He is the national co-coordinator of the Alliance for Global Justice. And in our Washington, D.C. studio by Walter Smolarek. He is a Sputnik News analyst. Welcome, Walter and Chuck.
Thank you.
Glad to be here.
Chuck Kaufman, the results of the election seem to be completely different from when we talked to you a couple days ago, when it appeared that the left-leaning alliance or left alliance had won the election. Surprisingly, now it turns out not to be the case. I mean, it's an amazing turnaround. Is this an election coup?
Well, I would say you could call it exactly that, and it mirrors very much what happened in 2013 when Juan Orlando Hernandez was selected in the first place.
Yeah, Walter, let's go back, because we have to remind the audience that this election, coming after the 2013 election, comes after a coup d'etat that was supported by, yes, the United States, yes, by Hillary Clinton. What's going on?
Yeah, so there's even another level of absurdity, because the pretext for the 2009 coup, like why the military said they had to do it and why their international supporters said it was okay, was because Manuel Zelaya, who was the president at the time, was conducting a non-binding referendum on the possibility of removing the prohibition on presidential re-election, which means, you know, like in the United States and most other countries, a president can run for re-election. So that was the pretext. That's why, you know, the military said we had to step in and defend democracy. And now Juan Orlando Hernandez changed the Constitution after he was selected, as Chuck said, in 2013, so that the president can be reelected. I mean, the exact same reason that there was, you know, theoretically a coup to begin with in the first place. The 2009 coup was carried out when Hillary Clinton was the Secretary of State. Information has come out that the U.S. government played a significant role in it.
Chuck, when we talked to you last, you talked about your experience as an election observer in the last election, and you saw widespread voter fraud. That's why you were surprised that this time it appeared that Nasrallah, the opposition candidate, would even be given permission to win. And you said, oh, the existing powers that be, Hernandez, was down on his fraud game compared to 2013. But now perhaps they got their game together. Is that what's going on?
Yeah, it looks that way. A little bit after 3 p.m. yesterday, the computers at the Supreme Electoral Tribunal, the independent branch of government, supposedly independent branch of government responsible for elections, the computers crashed. Same thing happened in 2013, and it was during that downtime that that it's believed that many false tally sheets from the what we would call precincts, they call them tables, voting tables in Honduras, were entered into the computer. That the Supreme Electoral Tribunal never actually counted the physical tally sheets, they counted what has been scanned into the computer. In 2013, the Libre Party brought a lawsuit, trying to force the counting of the physical tally sheets, and the courts threw it out. So it looks like they're just replaying the same game in 2017.
Yeah, and talk about the relationship between the current Honduran government and the United States, if you would.
Oh, yeah. Juan Orlando Hernandez seems to be the darling in Central America of the United States. Honduras, a couple of years ago, was called the murder capital of the world, and now supposedly, magically, those homicide numbers have dropped way off because Juan Orlando Hernandez supposedly is tough on crime. It's all just manipulation of statistics, and he's probably got the most corrupt government in Honduran history, and certainly with ministers who are parts of the drug cartels.
I have a question. You know, back even during the Reagan administration, which I think is saying a lot, we found ourselves getting to a point as a government where we were able to stand up and tell foreign despots like Ferdinand Marcos, that, for example, that enough is enough, right? That the people have spoken, you lost the election, it's time to move on. Why are we not seeing that now, whether it's under Donald Trump or under Barack Obama? Why is it that a government like this is allowed to steal an election? And there's not a single word out of the State Department or the White House.
Well, I don't think we ever objected to a despot because of his effects on his own people.
When the people were rising up and about to overthrow the government, the U.S. would drive them. The U.S. would drive a U.S.-sponsored dictator like Marcos or the Duvaliers in Haiti. They'd drive them to the airport and say, "See, we're with you."
Yeah.
We're with you, those people fighting for democracy. But I want to go back to the essence of John's point is, what does the U.S. get out of support for a dictatorial regime? In other words, it's not simply tolerating a dictatorship. There must be something in it for the U.S. or perceived to be in it for the United States.
Well, one of the most concrete things that's in it for the United States is the Palmarola Air Base. It's the only U.S. base north of Colombia, and it, in my mind, that was the real reason that the U.S. supported the coup against Zelaya in 2009, because Correa in Ecuador had just closed the Manta Air Base, U.S. Air Base there. And so the U.S. was not about to lose face and have another of its major bases closed. And Zelaya was threatening to convert it to a civilian airport.
Yeah, the U.S. doesn't want it, to lose military bases ever. I mean, once the U.S. comes in someplace, they're just there
forever.
They're there. And John Kelly, Donald Trump's chief of staff, he was in
Southcom.
He was in charge of Southcom.
He was Latin
America. So, I mean, do we think, Walter or Chuck, that the Trump administration or John Kelly, who obviously is a hardliner from the Pentagon and also in charge of Latin American operations for the Pentagon, do you think there's a direct link here?
Oh, absolutely. And there's also a direct link to the U.S. efforts to overthrow the government of Venezuela.
Yeah, with Venezuela, it's interesting because Rex Tillerson is the Secretary of State, and ExxonMobil lost a lot in the wave of nationalizations that came with the Bolivarian Revolution. I think that there is a element of, like, you know, personal commitment, but there's also continuity with this. I mean, the 2009 coup happened under the Obama administration. I think the strategic impulse in Latin America remains the same in the sense that they want to arrest and reverse the trend of progressive and left-wing governments. And of course, there's various shades of progressive and left-wing included in this. But, you know, there's a general trend towards creating regional institutions that exclude the United States. So there's the CELAC was formed, the Community of Latin American and Caribbean States. There is UNASUR, the Union of South American Nations. There's MERCOSUR, there's ALBA. You know, there's this range of sort of Latin American integration, Latin American sovereignty mechanisms that didn't exist prior to the quote-unquote pink tide that began in, you know, the late 90s, early 2000s. And so, you know, if you can get rid of a government like Zelaya's, which didn't start out as very radical, but it moved into the camp of Venezuela, Bolivia, Cuba, Ecuador, et cetera. If you can take out one of those governments, then it kind of shifts the momentum a bit. And if you can take out Venezuela, which, you know, Chuck, I agree with Chuck, is a top priority of the Trump administration, then that really shifts the momentum. Same thing with the impeachment, the, you know, coup really against Dilma Rousseff in Brazil, the victory of Macri in Argentina and so on.
Well, you know, we had the Monroe Doctrine established as a fundamental part of U.S. foreign policy back in 1823, basically telling European powers, guess what? Latin America is our backyard. It's ours. And it seems to me that that's really still the operational principle here.
Oh, yes.
And every country, you know, you might say the U.S. always labels independence movements or movements that want to be independent in any way from the United States as subversive or communist or terrorist. It doesn't really matter. The U.S. wants to have Latin America as a semi-colony.
But it's very, yes, it's very patriarchal too, because it's in the United States' interest to develop the economies of these countries, probably more than any other countries in the world, right? We want our backyard to be economically successful and to be able to provide for their own citizens. Yet we do nothing to help them.
Yeah, except there's Fort Benning, Georgia, where the U.S. is, in fact, training every military in the past before the pink tide, before the left movement. Anyway, we're completely out of time. We've been speaking with Chuck Kaufman. He's the national co-coordinator of the Alliance for Global Justice. We will be back tomorrow. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and you want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. We are out of here.
Loud and Clear. Thank you.